All right, can we do this podcast here? Yes, we can. All right, 3, 2, 1. I'm Elton Jim, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode, episode 35, in fact, of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic, right here on WGNplus.com, which you now can find through the WGN website. Thank you for tuning in. We've got some fun stuff to talk about today. Another pop culture club, as well as some other things. I hope you enjoyed the one-man version of A Christmas Carol, which was last week's podcast. I had a real fun time doing that. And I did that on the air, actually, at WGN when I filled in over the Christmas holidays, and so I thought it might be fun to share that with the podcast audience as well, because now you can have that forever, and you can use that at Christmas time to help inject some early Christmas spirit into your moods right after Thanksgiving. And in fact, as I've told you on this podcast and many times before, this year, or last year in 2016, I started putting my Christmas decorations up in mid-November. I forget that Thanksgiving, waiting for Thanksgiving thing. I needed Christmas cheer early today. I put my, this last year, 2016, so I put my stuff up in the middle of November. And in fact, just took it down the first week of January. It took 10 hours. 2 days, 10 hours. Got a lot of stuff. But anyway, I hope you did enjoy the one-man performance of It's a Christmas Carol. I hope you will keep that and play it every Christmas. I actually have not heard it from beginning to end, but I was there because I did it, and it was fun. And as I said, I hope you enjoy that. But well, the last time since we talked on this podcast, I had a birthday on January 8th, Sunday, January 8th, and it was a good time. It was a Sunday, so it was kind of low-key. We went out and for a nice dinner the night before, and sort of just hung out. And I actually had a nice surprise guest, if you will, surprise gift on my birthday. My godson, Patrick, who is frequently on this podcast, stopped by and we spent some time. And that was nice. But, you know, the thing about birthdays, aside from the number, I am not caught up on the number. Although those numbers are getting bigger. But I've always had an odd relationship with birthdays. And I know there's some people that love their birthday and they love to celebrate their birthday. And they have some elaborate things, whether it's parties or they get together and they dress up or they have surprise parties or they have traditions or who knows what. But I mean, people, some people really celebrate the heck out of their birthday. And there's nothing wrong with that. And it's nice that within the span of a 365-day year that we actually celebrate ourselves. So there's nothing wrong with that. But I've always had an odd relationship with my birthday. And not to get, you know, to use the podcast here as any kind of psychiatrist's couch, but I don't know what it is, and maybe you know, and maybe you can send me a message on Facebook or to tell me when you hear this. But I haven't really told, you know, anybody professional about it. But this is kind of my own theory as to why I have a problem with birthdays, and it's been since I was a little kid. Like I said, age has the number of my age has nothing to do with it. I've just always, like, from a little kid, my birthday was always celebrated in grand fashion. I was an only child. My mom and dad gave me great parties, you know, family parties as well as kiddie parties. I'll never forget one year, you know, one of my kiddie parties, we played bingo. That's how high-tech we were back in the 70s. But my dad was giving away, like $10 and $15 and $20 prizes for bingo. I mean, for like 8-year-old kids, that was like $1 million. I mean, this was like serious bingo. That party was talked about for many weeks at school afterwards. Wow. We actually made some money at Jim's party. And $20 back in the 70s? That actually was real money. So anyway, my mom and dad went all out. There was nothing about, geez, I never got, you know, anything for my birthday. Now, I will mention that once again, my birthday is January 8th. That is 2 weeks after Christmas. So, yeah, initially, maybe there is a little oddness about it because, you know, there's Thanksgiving, there's Christmas Eve, there's Christmas Day, there's New Year's Eve, there's Christmas Day. And then a week later after Christmas Day is my birthday. Okay, how many times can people celebrate in a two-month period, in a month-and-a-half period? So, like a lot of times, just to be nice, my mom would have my family party, because we used to get together with most of the same family for all those holidays. She would push the party back like till late January just to give people a break, because how many times can you keep seeing the same people and pretending that you're glad to see them and have fun? It's like I just saw you last week, and I saw you the week before that, and I saw you 3 weeks before that. So right away, my birthday was kind of like pushed back. But my kiddie party was always around that time, so I can't complain. What I kind of did complain about, never outwardly, but sort of in my head, is that because my birthday was so close to Christmas, and it was after Christmas, some people, not a lot, but some people that gave me gifts would do the old combination gift. Which I have no problem with the combination gift, if in fact the combination gift is twice as big as the normal gift. Because if my birthday was in June, you couldn't give me a combination gift in January. You have to buy me a separate gift. So I'd get a Christmas gift and a birthday gift. That's two gifts. So if you're going to do the combo gift, which I have no problems with, but then, you know, it can't just be a jump rope. It's got to be twice as big, because if my birthday was in July, you would have to have gone out and bought me another present. So if it's going to be a combo, then it better be a combo. It better be a legitimate combo. And not everybody did it, but a few did. And so from a young age, I was able to discern as to who were the cheapskates in my life and who weren't. And that's pretty depressing when you're an eight-year-old kid to start deciding which relatives you have are cheapskates. And you make that realization. So, okay. But the biggest, and at the birthday parties. Now, if anybody's listened to me in any kind of way over the last several years on the radio and even during these podcasts, you know, look, I'm not someone that shies away from the spotlight. I certainly enjoy talking and sharing and performing. I act. I'm on a stage. So believe me. And from a young age, I've always enjoyed being out in front of people and doing things and performing, whatever you want to call it. So I've never been nervous. I've always enjoyed public speaking. I always, in school, I always liked to give speeches or, you know, be on debates or whatever it was. I whenever there's a hot mic, I always find my way toward it. So from a young age, I've always enjoyed that. But I also remember when I would have my birthday parties, whether it was the kids' party or the family party, as much as you think, well, now this is perfect, right? I mean, who, you being this, you know, narcissistic, egomaniac, you have to love your birthday, right? I mean, here's the day that everybody, you know, supposed to celebrate you, and you're the big cheese. And yet, as that would make sense, I always felt very uncomfortable at my birthday parties. In fact, that happy birthday song was to me the most excruciatingly long. I couldn't wait for it to end. I don't know why. A few times I would even try to trick my mom. Well, we don't need to sing that. I mean, I didn't like the song, and I didn't like people sort of, you know, singing it to me. And I think, I never could figure out why, but I always just wanted that to get over with. And as we all know, if you're throwing a birthday party for somebody, that's like the best part. You shut the lights out. You're all proud of this cake that you bought. And you put all the candles on it. And you walk in. And the only light in the room is the candles. And everybody starts to sing. And you're sitting in the grand spot. And this cake is put in front of you. And you are like the king of the castle. And one thing that my mom and dad always did too. There is a bakery here in Chicago on North Avenue called Roser's. And we didn't even live that close to it. So it wasn't like it was around the block. But they used to go to Roser's because they would make number cakes. So like every birthday up until a point, I think as I stopped having, you know, birthday parties probably in my teens, I would assume, probably when I'd be, you know, 13 or 14, 15, whatever it was. But whatever age was, that was my cake. So I was an 8 cake or a 7 cake or a 9 cake. And then when you get to double digits, it was 2 cakes. It was 10, 1-0, 1-1. So these were elaborate cakes. And so, of course, you know, my mom wasn't gonna you know, pass up the unveiling of the cake because they probably spent $20 or $30 back then. So, but when they sing you the song, I couldn't wait for the song to end. And this whole idea of people singing to me, I always was very uncomfortable. And I think as I got older, I tried to figure this out. And what I've come up with, whether this is valid or not, whether it's true or not, but this is sort of what I've been thinking in my head as to why I've always been kind of weird about my birthday, is I never felt like I deserved that. I mean, I didn't do anything. I don't mind, believe me, I don't mind being complimented. It's always nice to be complimented on something that you do. And so this birthday thing, even at a young age, kind of didn't sit straight in my head. I mean, how could you not like this? There's this giant cake. There's all these people with hats on. They're all singing to you. They're giving you presents, and they're wishing you a happy birthday. I mean, in theory, this birthday thing should be a slam dunk. You should have no one should ever have any problems with celebrating their birthday. And yet I have. In fact, to be honest with you, I think it actually disappoints my wife because she enjoys her birthday, and I usually go all out in celebrating her birthday. But if she tries to do a lot of big stuff for me, I'm always like, what are you doing? Why'd you buy me something? I don't need anything. What did you get a cake for? You know? And I feel bad. Although I must say, so this year, I do need a psychiatrist couch probably. So I've always complained. Every year my wife has been, you know, we've been married for 25 years. 26 years, and I've known her since I was 16, all right? So there's a lot of birthdays here. And, you know, she's always, and when I was younger, sure, it was great. But as last few years, I'm like, you know, I don't need stuff. You know, don't buy me anything. I don't need a cake. You know, that, once again, that happy birthday thing. Yeah. So the funny thing is, but she always does. And I'm always kind of, you know, sheepishly, well, why'd you do this? And I'm sure that ruins it for her. So I know that I'm being selfish in that way, but at the same time, I just have this kind of reaction to it. The funny thing is, so this year, she bought me a card. She goes, you know what? I know you don't like anything. Here's your card. Here's my card, physically, right here. And I'm looking around. What? No present. What? No cake. I didn't say anything to her. But so what? I've always complained that I don't want anything. And she gets me stuff and makes a big deal about it to some extent. I mean, it's just her and I. Now, this year, she finally probably said to herself, you know what? Why am I even bothering? The best gift I could possibly give this guy is not to make a big deal. In fact, she said, I'm going to give you the best gift you ever got. I'm not going to do anything about your birthday. And to be honest with you, I was a little disappointed. So, yeah, it is no piece of cake, no pun intended, living with me. It's very hard. But here's the great thing. I have to say, I brought this for the show. She bought me such a great card. Talk about knowing me. And if you've talked, if you listened to the podcast over the last several months since May, you know that I'm very old school on a lot of things. I have a flip phone. I'm not a big texter at all. You know, if you've listened to my millennial meter stuff with my godson, you'll know, you know, to me, a lot of technology is because we can, not because we should or because we want to. It's because we can. I mean, that Pokemon Go thing, what was that? It was because we could. I mean, I remember the summer, just standing, people walking with their heads down, almost getting hit by cars. I'm like, what? And then I'm like, oh, wait a minute, they're playing Pokemon Go. Oh, my gosh. So here's the great card that she bought me. On the cover of the front of the thing, it's got, it's drawings. It's not like pictures, but it says cassette tapes, and there's like a drawing of a cassette tape. Analog TV, there's like a big hunky TV. Film cameras, there's a little camera with a flash cube. And then you, and there's a little picture of a person. And then inside it says, respect the classics. The funny thing is, I have all three of those things. So she knows me, there's no doubt about that. But this whole thing, what I actually believe, as I said, getting back to the birthday thing, is I've never felt like birthdays are something that you did anything to deserve. You didn't accomplish anything. And as I got older, I actually thought about it and said, well, maybe that's why. Because, you know, once again, I was an only child and I was very kind of, you know, driven and ambitious. And so, I mean, I did things to accomplish things. That's, you know, and sort of to show your mom and dad, hey, look at me, you know. So maybe that whole thing of this idea of this unconditional, you know, celebration is odd to me. But then I also thought, isn't really the birthday about your parents? I mean, we have no memory of our birthday whatsoever. And let's face it, the only reason that our birthday is on that day is either because of a excruciating, painful, muscular thrust that happened on that day, or a prearranged cesarean date that the doctor said, I'm available on January 8th. That's how our birthday is basically decided. We had no say in this. And we didn't really have anything to do with it because it was nature that decided right now is time to, you got to get out of here. I know it's comfortable and it's nice and warm and wet, but you got to get out there and start breathing. But we did nothing about that. But now, if you ask us about our birthdays, we have absolutely no memory. But who can tell you everything about that day? Our parents. Huge day in their lives. Perhaps the biggest day, if you're the first child, especially, they never had a kid before. But regardless, any birth of a child has to be a memorable day. So you can't tell me that a parent, if you say, well, so what happened on my birthday? They will know when the contractions started and how we got to the, did we take a cab? Did we take a car? Did we take an Uber? To the hospital? Were you born in a taxi? You know, they know they're like a TikTok, every minute. They know what happened on that day, and they'll remember the moment you were born. I remember my mom telling me the story. I mean, I guess when I was born, I wasn't breathing, and so there was no crying. I was actually pulled out with the forceps. My birthday picture, I look like I was like Rocky Balboa at the end of the first Apollo Creed fight. I have this huge black and blue mark because I actually got pulled out with the forceps, and I wasn't breathing. And so my mom is like, you know, oh, my gosh. And then, you know, the doctor, I guess, whacked me a couple of times. And I started talking. And I haven't stopped since. But, you know, I remember my mom telling me that story. I mean, so the actual birth details and my dad talking about, you know, in those days, the fathers were not in the delivery rooms. And he was telling me where he was and how he got to the, you know, to the hospital and blah, blah, blah. And the whole thing. They know that is a huge day in their lives. They created this life, And then on this day, it came to be. And this thing that then they nurtured and supported and loved, you know, their whole lives, you know, the birth of a child in somebody's life. Now, I don't have any kids, but I can only assume it's got to be the greatest moment in your life and unforgettable. So I actually think that on our birthday, we celebrate our birthday, but I always think that birthday should be a celebration of the parents, because it was their decision and it was their day. It was a life-changing event for them. Now, we may have some life-changing events later in our lives that we actually have something to do with. But I think that, you know, I understand the whole idea of the birthday. I get it. And I'm not putting anybody down if you enjoy it, you know, if you love your birthday. I understand. But I'm just getting you my standpoint is that I also think that our parents should be celebrated, because too often it's all about us and they're the ones throwing us the parties when we're little kids. But shouldn't they get a nice little applause? The thank you shouldn't be just for the cake. It should be thank you for bringing me here. It was their day. And so, you know, my parents have been dead now for over 10 years. My dad, 11 years. My mom, 10. But every birthday, I go to the cemetery. On my birthday, I go to the cemetery and visit their, you know, their crypt of the mausoleum. Because I really believe that it was their day. And, yeah, we celebrated it together. And I'm sure in the back of their minds, while they're giving us the parties, or when we are celebrating our birthday, in our parents' mind, they are kind of remembering the whole situation and all the events and all the memories of the pregnancy, as well as then the birth and, you know, the first day home and all that stuff. But I really think that on a birthday, the parents should be a little more involved. And I'm saying this now in retrospect. But I remember even my parents, you know, last few years, you know, when they would celebrate my birthday, I would raise a toast to them. So, I mean, I did do that in their lifetime. But it just seems strange, as I said, I've always had this odd relationship with my birthday. And I don't know. I mean, a psychiatrist might say, well, are you trying to say that you don't deserve this kind of attention from people? And because you didn't, you know, I don't know what the psychological ramifications of this is. But at the end of the day, at the very least, hopefully, this kind of viewpoint of the parents and their importance on our birthday maybe is something that you can take with you. And if your parents are still around and you have that great opportunity, and believe me, if you still have your parents around, you don't realize the great gift you have. Take it from somebody whose parents are no longer around. And so if it is, when it's your birthday, certainly celebrate the hell out of it. Do whatever you want to do, whatever you always do. But at the same time, if your mom and dad are still there, or one of the two, you know, don't be afraid to turn the spotlight toward them and say, thank you not only for celebrating my birthday, but I think we should give these two people or this person a nice little round of applause and a little celebration and a little song. Somebody needs to write a song for them, because at the end of the day, they're the ones that got the whole ball started. Elton Jim, back here with you at the Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. And as I said, I was talking about my birthday. It is interesting, you know, several years ago, I am glad that I don't get presents. In fact, one of the best presents, it was great that my wife kind of just gave me this card, because I sort of did appreciate that because I've got enough stuff. And probably one of my best birthday presents that I got was a surprise visit from my godson, Patrick, who called later in the day and said, "Hey, what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, we're just sitting around." And he said, "Well, do you mind if I come by?" And I said, no, of course not. And so, he came by. I'm into hard apple cider these days. Don't ask me why. So he bought me a little four-pack of some hard apple cider, and he bought me a nice little card, and he spent a couple hours just talking with my wife and I, and that was really the best birthday gift that I got. And I remember a few years ago, I was even talking about getting rid of a lot of junk and a lot of stuff that I don't need anymore and going down in the basement and filling up all these bins and throwing some stuff out. And I told, actually, our former producer here at WGN, this is where I brought it up. And I was telling her how, yeah, you know what, I'm starting to go in the basement and just clear stuff out. I said, I'm decluttering. I need to declutter. And maybe when I turn 50, I said, I need to start to declutter. And I said, I'm going to start getting rid of a lot of stuff. And just, I said, from now on, I'm going to start collecting experiences. I'm not going to collect stuff. And she's like, well, that's depressing. That's depressing. It sounds like you want to die. I said, no, I'm not. No, I'm just trying to simplify. Because at the end of the day, plus two, I have no kids, as I said earlier. Who's going to get all this stuff? I got a lot of bins, and I got 20 Christmas bins. I hope to God my godson likes when I invite him and his wife over to see our house. I hope you guys like all this stuff, because if you don't like it, I don't know who's getting it. But yeah. So actually, that was the best gift I got was not a thing, not stuff, but that nice visit from my godson Patrick. So I guess as you get older, maybe you don't need to be surrounded by stuff anymore. At least I don't, because I've been surrounded by stuff enough. One thing that I am surrounded by too on here on this radio show is one of the members of the Pop Culture Club, Emily Arminetti. Emily, are you there?
I'm here.
How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Well, I'm surviving. I just had a birthday.
I know you did. Happy late birthday.
Yeah. And so I'm just coming down from that, and then we're right in the middle of this. I mean, this podcast will, when this podcast is posted, we will still not have a president yet, but we almost will. So I can't keep saying, just wait till the guy becomes president, and then you can complain about him. But one of the things I did want to talk about, so first of all, we didn't do a podcast last week. Oh, can we, Craig Collins is producing the podcast today, so it's not officially the Pop Culture Club. Now, Emily, do you remember why I'm playing a George Michael song? Oh, no, I'm George Michael.
It's not George Michael.
Yeah. George Michael, Michael Douglas, Douglas Fairbanks, Fairbanks, Alaska.
Look, for starters, you can't confuse them now because one of them is dead and one of them is still alive. Okay, so let's
that's true.
Happy night. That's it's a little true. Bad for Boy George.
Well, I think he's dead because he's on the Celebrity Apprentice. Isn't that worse than death? Jeez.
Yeah, it may be a fate worse than death, I think.
But we are playing the Pop Culture song because this is pop culture, and it's a culture club, and that was his band.
Of course.
And Emily is one of our charter members of the Pop Culture Club. So we weren't here last week. Before we talk about the main topic I want to talk to you about in terms of pop culture news in the last week or so, you did not get a chance to give your remembrance of now I said Boy George this time instead of George Michael. I have to get my effeminate 80s '80s icons in order here.
It's a little confusing.
Well, like I said, Boy George, there was always this game you played. You connect like the names like in a little string. So Boy George, George Michael, Michael Douglas, Douglas Fairbanks, Fairbanks, you can keep going. So, now, I don't know your exact age. You've done a good job of keeping that hidden. However, I would assume that in the mid-80s, an Emily Arminetti had to have been a teeny.
I was alive.
You were alive, and I'm sure you were alive. You were a teeny bopper.
Well, I wasn't. I wasn't a teenager yet.
No, but you were a teeny bopper.
I was.
I mean, you were a teeny bopper.
I think when Wham came on the scene, which was of course George Michael's, you know, band.
84.
Yeah, that was 84, 83 or 84. Yeah, I was like a preteen.
Okay.
I'll just vaguely say I was a preteen.
Right.
I was old enough that I had discovered music.
Right. So George Michael clearly was a teen idol.
And, oh, yeah.
And I love the fact, like so many of the screen and music idols that were appealing to young women and young girls were homosexual.
Yes.
I mean, we know about Rock Hudson now. There was always rumors about him. I mean, Boy George actually vehemently denied being gay for many years until he couldn't when he got caught, you know,
right.
soliciting sex in a Beverly Hills bathroom.
Yeah.
So it is kind of, so now my question is, when you were a preteen mm-hmm. and you were watching MTV, were you taken by George Michael, the singer, or did you think he was dreamy?
Oh, well, I mean, both. For sure, I thought he was dreamy. For sure that I and all my friends were convinced that we were going to marry him. and there's Wham, right? Which is like one thing.
Right.
You know? And I will never forget, I think I told you this, but I was really bummed that I missed, I heard you and Michaela talking about his passing, and I was bummed that I missed that one because, you know, I mean, again, like this was like a critical time.
Well, that's why I wanted to give you a chance because, you know, it was us two guys just talking about him. It was more on the music side, but I did want to get the female side of the devotion and the infatuation with George Michael.
Yes, it's nice of you to give me a chance to pay homage. Okay, so I would say when I will never forget. The very first time I saw the video for Wake Me Up Before You Go Go. Okay.
Neither can I.
It was on MTV. This was still kind of in the early days. I would still consider it the early days.
Oh, certainly. Oh, yeah.
And I will never forget, and it's this video where he and Andrew Ridgely are bopping around on stage.
And he's got the white shorts with the,
And
it wasn't the Choose Life shirts?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if Choose Life was in Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go, but that was definitely like, if it wasn't that specific shirt, that may have come one single or two later, but it might have also been then. But that was definitely the look.
Right.
You know? And that became very big and iconic in the 80s. But they're bopping around on the stage, and I'm like... I have to marry this song. I am just like sitting there. First of all, I love this song. I love the video. I'm totally enthralled with this. And I have a couple this is at my aunt's house. There was like a family get together. I will never forget this. This is so many years ago, like decades ago. And I have a couple of older cousins. They're about 10 years older than me. So they were in high school at the time. And they were like, this guy, he's gay. And I was like, no, he's not.
No
and
way.
Sure. And then for years, I mean, even after, like, all through Wham, and then, of course, he launched his solo career. He had, you know, I mean, hits out the wazoo, you know, father figure.
Well, the Faith album, I mean, that Faith album when he wore the leather jacket. I mean, but now, the funny thing is.
Oh, the jeans, him in the jeans. With the leather jacket and the cross hanging from his ear, like my friends and I, we all definitely thought this was the guy we were going to end up.
But here's the thing: in retrospect, in retrospect, that was everything with the aviator glasses and the hair, the big pompadour hair, and the leather jacket and the tight jeans and the like you said, the earring with the cross and the whole kind of Elvis gyrations, you know, during Faith, you know, with the guitar.
Yeah.
I mean, he was clearly a gay icon. Everything about that screams gay. Everything that he was, that entire visual screams gay, and yet he was viewed as a sex symbol for women.
I know. And I'm sure gay men everywhere.
Of course.
Then.
That's
what we all know it now.
Isn't it crazy our gaydar was so different 25, 30 years ago? It was a different perspective. And there still was this naivete.
But I also think it's a little bit weird because it was a long time ago, and I get the sequence confused a bit. I always thought that Freedom 90, which was released in 1990.
Thus the name.
Well, because, of course, Wham had a single, a big hit that was also called Freedom.
Right.
So I think he had to make that distinction.
Right.
But, for some reason in my mind, many years later, I always thought that was sort of his way of coming out, because when you really read the lyrics of that song, but in fact, it wasn't. You're right.
No.
It wasn't until years later when he had this brush with the law that he was essentially outed, and it kind of forced his hand to then admit, I think, in a press interview that, yes, in fact, he was gay.
Well, think about
it. It does make me feel, I feel sad for George Michael that's the way that all played out. You know, nobody should be outed, of course. But I do feel like there was something in him that was kind of wanting to be himself when he released Freedom 90. And I mean, when you really look at the lyrics to that song and, of course, the video, which became so iconic with all of the supermodels of the day, you know, he didn't want to appear in the video himself. There was an issue with his recording label. And so he came up with this clever way of avoiding being in the video. And then the video became, you know, really iconic because they have the supermodel singing the song. But if you really look at all of that very closely, I feel like he was just dying to be himself and come out and be able to publicly be himself even back then.
Well, I think, and I think that that's not even a surprise, because I would think that most people have that inherent feeling to want to be themselves.
Sure.
And I'm sure that,
sure.
And if you talk to, I mean, nowadays, you know, it's a badge of honor. I mean, nobody pretends that if they are gay, they certainly don't hide. I mean, well, there actually are a few, I think, that still do hide it. And, we can mention some names.
But if you're George, and it depends on the situation, if you're George Michael and you're at the height of your career and you're this massive sex symbol, you know, and there's a lot of money at stake, there are probably people in your life who want to make sure that.
Oh, there's no question about that.
Carry on. Yeah.
I mean, think about it, too. I mean, then he had that song, I Want Your Sex, you know, which was viewed as, once again, oh, my God, he's this super sexy stud that women were going, you know, that we're going crazy for. And as I said, in many interviews throughout the years, he continued in a very vehement way to deny it. And I'm sure that, that behind the scenes, I mean, it was a well-known fact. I mean, I remember him going out on dates with Brooke Shields.
Right. Well, yeah, Brooke Shields, I think, was...
Well, she was, yeah.
She was a beard for a few
she was
people,
a, Yeah, no? She was a beard for Michael Jackson.
Right.
And his chimp. But, yeah, I mean, so...
Right.
But they did try to, to certainly portray that. And even well into, you know, the 90s, that was still, as I said, it wasn't... I mean, you know, not to always, you know, use Elton John as an example, but, you know, Elton John was clear that he was gay. And yet, once again, with the costumes and the whole thing.
Well, at a certain point, though, right? Because wasn't he married to very early in the 70s?
Well, no. He was married in 1984, in fact. He got married to a woman. But at the height of his popularity, in 1976, he had just finished this huge concert tour that, wound up with 12 sold-out shows at Madison Square Garden, which was a record. And still, I think that record still stands. Now Billy Joel has surpassed him, because Billy Joel had been doing this monthly thing at Madison Square Garden. But Elton, up until 10 years ago, held the record for most sellouts at Madison Square Garden. And like I said, in 76, he was at the peak. He had Don't Go Breaking My Heart, and he had just had two albums that entered the charts at number one, Philadelphia Freedom, Lucy Ascari. I mean, it was just it was huge. And I think in Rolling Stone, In the peak of this, I think he wanted to get off the fame train, and he knew the only way that was going to happen, because anything he released at that time just became number one. And I think he realized the one thing he had in his pocket that would kind of derail this was his sexuality. And so on a cover story in Rolling Stone in 1976, he came out and said he was bisexual. Now, he didn't say he was gay. He said he was bisexual.
Right.
Because that was still, he was still hedging, I think. But at least the idea of sexuality came out. And in fact, in the United States, not so much in Britain, because they have a little more of an open-mindedness at that time, at least, about homosexuality. But here,
yeah.
in, the, but here in the United States, here in the United States, it almost overnight derailed his career. And I think he actually, yeah, and I think he actually did that on purpose. He's never said that, but it seems to me from the, you know, the articles that I read, he was not very happy personally. This is, and this gets back to your point. He was not very happy hiding this fact. He was living with, his manager was his boyfriend. And I mean, you know, so the irony was he was living this lifestyle, but yet if you went to the grocery store, like, you know, remember those teen magazines like Teen Beat and Tiger Beat and 17 and all that?
Of course. Where do you think I got all of the posters of Johnny Depp hanging on my wall?
Well, Elton was in all of those, and it was like win a dream date with Elton.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, he was used as, you know, this...
Although I have to say, Elton, he's not really a sex symbol-y kind of guy.
No, but my point is, in the 70s, he was...
gay. He's...
But he was so popular that it was like win a date with Elton kind of thing.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So my point is, he was living this kind of double life. So I'm thinking George Michael's case, I think he was very torn. I think people behind the scenes knew, certainly was going on. And in fact, you know, George Michael, as I said even on the podcast a couple weeks ago, was very instrumental in resurrecting Elton John's career when they did the duet of Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me.
Yeah.
Which was a huge hit for Elton in 1974. On his own album, and then George Michael covered it with Elton, and that became a number one song. And again, well, it was number two here in the United States.
I remember that song.
Yeah. So, but I mean, I when you look at George Michael, like I said many times, you know, he had an amazing voice, amazing talent. He certainly was iconic. But
and I have to tell you, you know, in recent years, I mean, so we're talking within the last kind of 10 years. When I was living over in the UK, I had the opportunity to see him twice. I saw him once at Wembley in London, and then I saw him, I went with a friend of mine who's Swedish, but she lived in London, and we went to see him in Stockholm.
Oh, nice.
Kind of a fun girls' weekend, but we went specifically to see George Michael, and he was just phenomenal. I was not expecting his voice to be as good
no.
as it was, but it really held up so well over the years. He had an amazing voice. He put on a great show. I feel really lucky that I had the chance to see him those couple of times. Of course, you know, his recent death was very unexpected. But, you know, his career in the last couple of decades, it's not as if he had been, you know,
well, the thing,
as big as he was in the 80s.
Well, here's the thing. You know, sadly, given his age, and when you've seen even now, I mean, he passed away before Christmas, and there are still people talking about George Michael, and there will be. He falls into the sweet spot for a lot of Generation X people, like yourself, who that was their guy. You know, that was their sex symbol. And those people are now the people who are working at magazines or producing television shows or are sort of pushing the pop culture media. So someone like George Michael, I believe, his legacy and his popularity and his loss is going to be very big, just like Prince's was. Because once again, it was those right now, anybody in the 80s, if they pass away, who was big in the 80s, is going to be, look at the way they made a big deal about Alan Thicke. Alan Thicke! But he had a popular show in the 80s.
What did you say about Alan Thicke?
Well, this is my point, because you have a connection with Alan Thicke because you watched Growing Pains.
My generation.
That's what I'm saying.
Like maybe next to Cliff Huxtable, he was like my generation. He's so, like America's father.
So that's what I'm saying is anybody now, that's why you saw such an outpouring of media coverage on Prince, and I think you're still seeing it on George Michael, and you will continue to see anybody that was a huge iconic, you know, star in the 80s. Look at the way Cyndi Lauper now is being heralded as this great, you know, I mean, everybody sings Time After Time like it's My Way. You know, I mean, that song is taken
out. That is a great song, Jim.
I understand. Well, see, here we go. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying anything against it. But my point is, to your generation, and believe me, hey, I was only 21 or 22 when Cyndi Lauper was popular, too. I was playing her music when I was in college. So, you know, on the radio station. So I was there, too. You know, I'm not that old. But my point is, for someone, you know, usually the music that we grow up with when we're like between 10 and 13 and 14, that's that sweet spot music where we, like you just said, you know, you were beginning to recognize music. It was important to you. And whatever the music and the songs and especially those performers that really, you know, appeal to you or you know, brought you in, those are the ones that stay with you. And so, like I said, I won't be surprised if George Michael's, you know, legacy is even more, you know, heightened and elevated because the people writing about it now, that was your music, you know?
Yeah. But, as I said, I think he was a huge talent and it was a real shock and it's such a huge loss. So I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity, even though you guys already talked about it, but you know,
I think it was to be able to at least acknowledge. No,
it.
I wanted to get your perspective because not only from a a female side, but also from someone who, you know, looked at, because once again, I wasn't looking at him as a pop, as an idol, as a teenager. I didn't want to marry him, even though I had a better chance than you did.
Right. that's the cruel irony. Yeah.
So here's what I wanted to talk about briefly about our Golden Globes. We talked about the Golden Globes a few weeks ago, about it being, you know, kind of the first kickoff of the award season for movies and entertainment.
Yeah.
And I told you I wasn't too crazy about Jimmy Fallon hosting.
Right.
And I think that I was proven. Because without a teleprompter, he didn't know where the hell he was.
I really hate to say that you're right.
Okay, yeah, I can hear it in your voice, but you have to admit.
What?
I mean, that was to me, I mean, here's the thing. The Golden Globes are supposed to be a ragged, sloppy award show. That's the charm. It's not supposed to be like the Oscars. And, you know... But when Jimmy Fallon there, as I said before, he's so eager to please. So you had these pre-taped things, and they had, of course, he had to bring, you know, Justin Timberlake with him. It's practically connected. Right. They're practically Siamese twins now. Whenever Jimmy Fallon wants to make an impression, he always brings Justin Timberlake with him. And then I don't know what the heck.
Well, you know what's so funny is that Justin Timberlake, I mean, look, Jimmy Fallon is on TV every single night, and yet Justin Timberlake seemed more
I know.
And comfortable than he did.
I know. Well, Jimmy, like I said, I'm not impressed with Jimmy Fallon. And some people like him, you know, to play, you know, play Pong or beer Pong, you know, and that's your shtick. I don't know. But then he has to bring Questlove with him to DJ.
Right.
To remind everybody that he's on The Tonight Show, because once again, he can't do this alone. He needs all these human props. Ugh.
Well, yeah, and that was a little bit weird because I love Questlove, but I didn't actually feel like that element really brought anything.
No! There was no... It was.
So
it was.
That's what was weird. Most, it was the most weird about
it. Yeah, it was a very weird show. And here I go again. Now,
oh boy.
A couple of months ago... We debated this. You were fine with it, and I wasn't. When the cast of Hamilton came out and attacked Mike Pence, I said, I have no problem with the message. I have a problem with the venue.
Right.
And so here we are 2 months later. I love Meryl Streep. I think she's a great actress. I think if I went to a anti-Trump rally or if I went to a Freedom of the Press fundraiser, I would have loved her speech. But she was there to get an award for her acting and to ramble on about Donald Trump instead of accepting the award that was not the right venue. And I got news for people say, well, yeah, but, you know, she had the eyes of the world. I mean, this was her chance. Well, you know what? She angered so many people that people got disgusted, didn't even want to listen to what she said. So I got news for you. You didn't speak to that many people because half the people probably turned it off or muted it until you were gone when they saw where you were going. I want to hear about Sophie's Choice, and I want to hear about Kramer versus Kramer, and I want to hear about your movies. I want to hear about The Deer Hunter.
I want to hear about
Everybody Loves Prada.
Slapped her in the face right before they began filming.
Exactly. That's why she was up there. Why we did not celebrate Meryl Streep at the Golden Globes for her political views. And the other side of the coin is, you know, and then what's the other guy? That Tom Hibbles? What's his name? Hiddleston?
Oh, Tom Hiddleston.
Yeah.
Tom Hiddleston.
Okay, you know what? Go on Discovery Channel or Travel Channel and tell me about your trip to the Sudan. Don't tell me.
I think there are two different things happening there.
I understand that, but my point is, this is not the venue. And I talked about Colin Kaepernick, the football player. I have no problem with him being angry and you know, taking, you know, and being against whatever. But to not stand for the national anthem, wrong venue. That's not, you're not going to get your message across.
But this is the platform that they have. So I would say, like, Meryl Streep and Tom Hiddleston thing is kind of a different thing. I mean, I think with Tom Hiddleston, that was more, not so much a political statement as it was just kind of a cringy, humble brag. And I think that's also how it was received. You know, I think I don't think that's what he meant to say, but I think it just came out all wrong.
Well, my point is,
it was very tone deaf. Okay, but you know, Meryl Streep with her, and the reality is that Tom Hiddleston's talking about South Sudan because they were actually there.
I understand,
you know? and so there was some logical tie. It wasn't, you know, totally out of the blue. But with Meryl Streep, you know, look, I understand. I'm not surprised that this is your position. I think, you know, again, she's Meryl Streep. This is her platform, okay? And, yeah, there may be other ways for her to express her political views or, you know, to take action. But maybe she is doing other things. But she's got the stage. She's got the floor. She may have lost half of the audience. But it's her speech, and I think she can say what she wants. And I did think that at the very least, she did try to weave a narrative that made some sense. You know, she talked about, you know, the Hollywood Foreign Press. Her call to action was ultimately to the press to hold the powerful accountable.
What about out in Africa?
Yes, perhaps. But you know what? For Meryl Streep,
What about Bridges of Madison County?
Meryl Streep has had to watch gazillions of montages.
What about Silkwood? I want to know about Silkwood.
We got a little of the Silkwood.
I understand.
Silkwood alarm.
My point is, I understand what you're saying. I'm just saying, is it clearly now? It's very clear that, and don't forget, and Jimmy Fallon, I got another problem with him. I got a little problem with you, Fallon. Here's my problem with him. You know, he took a lot of heat when he had Donald Trump on his show, and he kind of played around with him. He messed up his hair. And a lot of, you know, Hollywood types were mad that he actually made Donald Trump kind of look, you know, interesting and fun because you're supposed to attack him because we all hate him. And so,
I didn't think that was right as people to do.
Yeah, but then what did he do in his monologue to try to save face? His monologue. I want to hear jokes about Julia Louis-Dreyfus. I want to hear jokes about the people that are in the audience. And what did he do? It was all anti-Trump jokes, trying to make up with that crowd because that's right in that room. That's the crowd. To make up for his Trump thing, he did, but
also Jimmy Fallon is doing this right on the cusp of the inauguration.
I understand that, but
it's more relevant. It's not totally random.
I understand that, but you know what? Jimmy Fallon was doing what he's supposed to do. He's a talk show host who had a guest on, and the goal is to be entertaining with that guest. And I'm sorry if you don't like that. Once again, I am not a Trump supporter. But what's driving me crazy is this constant rhetoric. And all I could say is wait until he becomes president. then you can argue and complain about the guy all you want. He's not even president yet.
He's not, but he is the president-elect.
I understand
so
that.
I think he's fair game.
But I've never seen a president-elect get so hammered in these 6 weeks before.
But Jim, that's because you've never seen a president-elect do the stuff that he is doing.
And here's another thing. All right, and now we've gotten off the Golden Globes, but I don't care. So everybody's complaining, especially the political media. Well, Donald Trump has to stop this tweeting because this is crazy and it's not presidential and all these tweets, and he's talking about Meryl Streep that she's a terrible actress, and he's talking about this and that.
Yeah.
Let me just, once again, I'm not supporting Trump, but I'm trying to be a little objective here. If Hillary Clinton or if Barack Obama had been using Twitter to talk to 49 million people, whatever it is that Trump has, you know what the media would be saying about that? This is the greatest outreach of a candidate who is using technology and transparency to talk directly to the people. He's not using spokespeople. He's talking right to his people immediately. He's letting them know what's on his mind or what's on her mind. And they're going to a new generation of voters and reaching out to young people, because this would have been, if Hillary or Obama were tweeting like Trump, this would have been the greatest thing that a candidate or a president-elect could have ever done. What they don't like is they don't like the content of Trump's.
Well, right. Of course not.
But it's not his tweeting. What's wrong with him tweeting? Aren't we all about transparency now?
I think people are concerned about the fact that he tweets at all hours of the night. And usually it's basically a reaction to something someone has said about him. Now, if he were tweeting out about, you know, some of his policy positions or, you know, some of the decisions that
I understand that
make, that I actually think that he would not get so beat up. But
well, I just
like,
think,
you know, when you're tweeting at 3 a.m. because you're upset that somebody said something about you that you didn't like.
Believe me, I'm not supporting him.
By the way, Hillary Clinton is on Twitter, and I think Barack Obama probably is too. But, you know, they use it in a very different way.
Yeah, I understand that. But I'm just saying is that there is a lot of double standards going on here. And now it's clear that at least until the Academy Awards in February and throughout maybe these next 4 years, every award show is going to be about Donald Trump. We are going to hear continual political speeches, certainly at the Oscars. There's no question about that, and at the SAG Awards.
Well, I don't know. I do think at the Oscars, I mean, it sort of depends. It all depends on how it's positioned. I mean, again, I did think Meryl Streep made a fair point. She's at an awards ceremony that is held by the Hollywood Foreign Press. These awards are given by them. And she did, I mean, the call to action.
I want to know about the Devil Wears Prada.
Was there on the press?
Devil Wears Prada.
Me too, man. I love that movie.
Well,
Tucci was brilliant in that. But I do think if we get to the Oscars and people are making
no way, it's going to be even worse at the Oscars.
If they're complete non sequiturs, then yeah, that gets old.
Look,
and it does get annoying.
In 1972,
we'll have to wait and see.
You weren't probably born, but this all started with Marlon Brando. When he won the Oscar for The Godfather, he sent up a Native American to talk about the troubles. He didn't accept the award, and he sent up, you know, a Native American woman, and she was giving this ridiculous, no one was listening. Now, the funny thing is that right now, though, you know, and he was castigated for that. The irony
is
that
people were a little confused about what was happening.
Well, but my point is, if someone did that, if someone did that today, they'd be praised. He was way ahead of his time. But the Oscars or an award show became politicized, the celebrities have felt that that is their duty. And here's the other side of the coin. Everybody in Hollywood, except for Scott Baio, was for Hillary Clinton. And she lost.
Right.
So Hollywood, no one's listening to you. Regardless of all this ticket sales and all your popularity and all your fans, no one's listening to who you think people should vote for. So here's my point. What point is making these speeches to this audience that isn't clearly listening to you? That's my point. I want to know about the deer hunter. I want to know about when she went out with John Cazale, or Cazales, who was in The Godfather and also in Dog Day Afternoon, and he died of cancer, and he was her boyfriend. I want to know about that. I don't want to know about, you know, what her feelings are about Trump. But anyway. Well, Emily, once again, thank you so much for having fun here in the Pop Culture Club. We did give you a chance to show your devotion and former love.
I know.
For George Michael.
So I am forever in your debt for giving me my chance, because I did miss it over the holidays. So
and so now I'm just going to say,
thank you for that.
I'm going to just say, wake you up before you go. Take care. Take care, Emily.
Thanks, Jim.
Emily Amornetti in the Pop Culture Club here. I'm Jim Tarano, and this is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic here at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, a new episode posted. So thank you for listening. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. Hope you'll come back every Monday and give a click to WGNplus.com. Elton Jim Tarano's Captain Podtastic, from the end of the web to your screens.